even at Wellington, which had its snobbish priorities, Cranwell at the bottom and Woolwich at the top, a story had circulated about a young man straight from school seeking employment, returning home one day to confront his parents. Shamefacedly he faced his father. "I'm afraid, father, you are not going to like this. Tell me the worst, my boy. I have taken a job playing a piano in a brothel." "Thank heavens," replied his father, "for an awful moment I thought you were going to say you had accepted a short service commission in the RAF." Further down the scale was another category, NCO aircrew, in a very different social class of their own from warrant officer down to corporal. It seemed completely wrong that after working together as a closely knit crew its members should part and go their separate ways to their various messes. Eventually all aircrew were commissioned, which was not only much fairer but it was far more convenient administratively for the whole crew to live together in one mess and if they were shot down to remain together in an officer's POW camp. The war introduced more categories into the caste system. The auxiliaries, easily recognized by the letter in their tunic lapels, and the university air squadrons. I remember standing stage-struck on the platform of a London railway station early in the war, gazing spellbound at the most delectable sight of an RAF flight lieutenant in an officer's greatcoat, collar turned up, polka dot silk scarf, no hat, suede shoes and an umbrella with, of course, the A nestling in the badges of his greatcoat rank. While the differences between Cranwell and short service officers were marked before the war, so the early volunteer reserve entries were about equally divided between public and non-public school entrants. At Marshall's we had been a small happy stream of ex-public school boys living and behaving in much the same manner as we had at school. At South Cerny all these small tributaries had come together into the mainstream of flying training and our group was much more varied in both age and background, so that the nearer we got to the front line the more the divisions became blurred. Courage and flying skill were no respecters of class. After joining in the war against the Third Reich, Canada, Australia and New Zealand were also determined to form their own flying squadrons to fight alongside the RAF. Thus an agreement was signed at Ottawa in December 1939, to establish the Empire Air Training Scheme. The dividends of training overseas in good weather away from dense centers of population had been appreciated well before the war by the RAF, founded on their experience with a flying school situated at Abu Suair in Egypt. England was to provide nearly all the aircraft and a nucleus of skilled men, while the others made up the rest. This great enterprise eventually expanded to 25 elementary flying training schools, 25 service flying training schools, 14 air observer schools, 14 bombing and gunnery schools and 2 air navigator schools in Canada, Australia and New Zealand. In addition, 3 service flying training schools were formed in Rhodesia, principally for the RAF, and South Africa also opened her own training facilities for the RAF. The first flying course began in Canada at the end of April, 1940. The scheme had the capacity to produce 11,000 pilots and 17,000 other aircrew a year. No training scheme of such magnitude and cost had ever been conceived before or since. The Empire Air Training Scheme proved to be of overwhelming advantage in gaining air superiority over our enemies, training a very large number of British, Dominion and Allied air crews, safe from interrogation, in the great open spaces and clear skies of the Commonwealth. So in July, 1941, with my posting to No. 36 SFTS, Penhold, Alberta, Canada, I became a minuscule and very reluctant cog in this great machine. I had struggled back from Malaya, deserted from the merchant navy to get into the fighting and now I was unceremoniously shunted even further westwards in the opposite direction. On hearing the news, my sister-in-law wrote, "How nice to hear that at least one member of the family is going to be safe." This was as good as being given a white feather. Almost the entire staff of the new school, headed by a group captain of First World War vintage, distinguished by his 1914-18 campaign ribbons, Pip, Squeak and Wilfred, assembled in Liverpool and boarded the Strathythan bound for Halifax, Nova Scotia. To Canada, the Straditon, like Cranwell, had not yet shed its peacetime elegance or ambience. We were treated like first-class civilian passengers in spacious accommodation, every whim attended to by white-jacketed stewards. The style was of sherry before dinner and vintage port afterwards, only the becking order was different, the tables being arranged in strict order of service seniority, with my new station commander removed as far as possible from his junior officers, seating himself firmly next to the captain of the ship, watching the charges intently for any breach of etiquette or discipline. We sailed on 7th of July, 1941, and our progress across the Atlantic was peaceful and measured, sailing far south to avoid German U-boats, disembarking in Halifax some 9 days later. Eight of us, under the command of squadron leader Maxwell, remained behind to ferry the school's first 8 Oxfords. These had been crated in England, shipped to Canada, and were now being reassembled at the Halifax Air Base. The remainder of our party set off by train on the 5-day journey across Canada to Calgary and Penhold, where they arrived in the middle of a great prairie stretching from horizon to horizon without aeroplanes, airmen or students. Meanwhile, in Halifax we waited and watched while our aircraft were assembled. As it turned out, the main problem was a complete lack of Trans-Canada route maps. The Oxford was not fitted with any kind of radio or navigation aids. This was finally overcome by a visit to a local garage which had enough road maps for our gallant leader, who then briefed us. All we had to do was to follow him across Canada from garage to garage. Our route took us across Canada to North Bay and Kapuskasing, Wagaming, Winnipeg, Verdun, Regina, and finally rough North Battleford, Saskatchewan, where the aircraft were to be based. It was a wonderful way to see Canada, and throughout our journey it was impossible not to wonder at the great air stations being constructed across the breadth of the land, bulging with Canadian, Australian, New Zealand, British and Allied airmen. From North Battleford we took the train to Calgary and then on to the Calgary-Edmonton line, where the train was persuaded to make a halt at the single-grain elevator called Penhold. Some time before the war, a bare airfield had been laid out at Penhold as an emergency landing field for civil aircraft, and it had excellent runways. By the time the RAF arrived, a hutted camp had been erected to the most basic standards necessary for flying training. It said a lot for Canadian heating systems that even in the depths of the Arctic Alberta winters the huts and hangars were incredibly warm. After England, the most striking thing about Penhold was its feeling of isolation in the vast flat prairie around us stretching across Alberta and Saskatchewan. To the west of Penhold you could just see the foothills of the Rockies, and on a clear day in the winter catch a glint of crystal white snow on the mountain peaks 100 miles away. I returned to Halifax to undertake some more ferrying, but instead received orders to escort our first contingent of airmen across Canada. I imagined this would be an undemanding task, but that could not have been further from the truth. As the train was dry, and despite my entreaties to remain on board, my faithful troops disgorged out of the station in large numbers at each halt in their endeavor to race to and from a liquor store before the train left again. Inevitably, many were left behind, and not a few decided it would be much more fun to abscond altogether, many ending up across the border in the United States, which was not then at war. I did not find it at all easy explaining to my group captain how I had managed somehow to lose 16 men in 5 days. Fortunately, the first course arrived on 30 September and we settled down to start flying instruction. The summers were hot and the winters harsh, although broken occasionally by the fine warm spells referred to as Indian summers. The spring and autumn were lovely, with the prairie carpeted by golden crops. The people, like the seasons, were both open-hearted and hardy. They were great party givers and goers, and the RAF were to prove very willing partners. The winters sometimes made flying difficult, with chill factors minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit not uncommon. Most of the time the weather was bright and clear, but sometimes snow was driven by mountain winds and great blizzards across the flat landscape, making it almost impossible to venture outside. On the coldest of these days it was necessary to start the aircraft in the hangars, slipping them out one by one before taxiing to the runway, otherwise even the oil froze. Except in blizzards, the weather seldom brought flying to a halt and very efficient Canadian snowplows kept runways clear, piling up the snow on either side until you took off and landed between two thick ice walls. Occasionally the Arctic winter was relieved for a while by a warm Pacific wind called a Chinook. Indeed, weather for flying throughout the year was so good that, unlike in England, we never fell behind our targets and were able to turn courses out like clockwork. The long winter provided many different kinds of activities, skating, curling and ice hockey, and it was only about 4 hours' drive through Calgary to Banff where there was excellent skiing at the weekends. I quickly fell in with the convivial company of my fellow instructors and indeed one, Flight Lieutenant Christopher Foxley Norris, who had already fought in the Battle of Britain, became a lifelong friend. As a very junior pilot officer, I was privileged to join the club of the less serious-minded officers consisting of the more experienced and blooded pilots, mostly distinguished and already bemedaled flight lieutenants. I soon discovered the real reason for my own initiation into this delightful circle. We seldom saw our revered station commander except on occasions in the mess. It became the practice of my band of new friends to push me forward in testing just how far we could go with our aloof station master in such matters as immoderate behavior, dress and drinking in the mess. It was not long before the group captain decided that this particular fly had bothered him long enough and I found myself duly marched into his office by a wing commander and swatted with an official reprimand known in RAF circles as an adverse report. The proceedings were not dissimilar to my first beating at Wellington. Nothing specific, just "I don't like your attitude, in fact your whole presence offends me." I replaced my headgear and was marched out and I don't recall that he ever spoke to me again. Month by month the war passed and I could only read about the great events in the occasional bundle of English papers which reached us: the German invasion of Russia, the first 1,000 bomber raid on Germany, the Battle of El Alamein. The war came a little closer as Penhold developed into a busy refueling stop for the steady stream of Bostons, Mitchells and Air Cobras heading north over Alaska to the Arctic where, on the very top of the world, Russian pilots took them over. Also the pressure on turning out courses became greater and greater as the enormous casualties in bomber commands demanded more and more replenishment air crews. Standards fell and it hardly mattered how bad the material was, as long as students could get off the ground and back onto it again in one piece they were fed through the syllabus as if through a sausage machine. Well satisfied with my work and rank now that I was a flight lieutenant, my social life settled into an orderly pattern. I spent most of my off-duty hours at the home of a local Canadian family, the Wests, in Innisfail, and courted the elder of their two charming daughters. Innisfail was about 10 miles south down the main tarmac road to Calgary, not a bad highway except when severe frosts cratered it deeply in the winter. The roads leading off it into the small village communities, of which Innisfail was one, were no more than rutted tracks. These small communities grouped along the main highway served the outlying prairie farmers. They were sleepy hamlets during the week but erupted at the weekends with the influx of farmers and the Ruthwen stores. Beer parlors and dance halls did a roaring trade, with Saturday night scenes not experienced since the gold rush. 2,000 or 3,000 people lived in Innisfail, which had one main street, dominated by the West's Country Store, with a few other shops, a cinema and dance hall. The main meeting place for the young was the drugstore, not a chemist's, for ice cream and hamburgers, owned by a Chinese who was eventually run out of town for distributing nude pinups with their heads substituted by cleverly touched up photographs of the town's leading ladies. There was also the church and an open air ice rink for the winter. The track led out of town a mile or so to the Red Deer River, where it crossed an iron bridge and fanned out into a number of even more rudimentary tracks to the isolated farmsteads, and westwards into the wild foothills of the Rocky Mountains. The longer I remained an instructor, the more I learnt about flying. The Tiger Mothan's tutor on which I had learnt to fly demanded some knowledge of airfoils and aerodynamics. A well-executed slow roll in a Tiger Moth needed a skillful movement of all the flying controls, elevators, rudder and ailerons, a coordinated effort of hands and feet largely unknown by today's pilots flying by computer. The Oxford, with its two Cheetah engines, was a much more difficult aircraft to manage, and because of this and its ability to absorb punishment, it was a good training aircraft. At this time, very little was known all about the theory of asymmetric flying. If you were unfortunate enough to suffer an engine failure, it became a question of using more and more opposite engine and more boot and rudder to compensate. The general idea was to stay in the air as long as possible in order to find a space suitable for landing. However, the Cheetah was a very reliable engine and I only experienced one failure. We were night flying from Innisfail on a particularly dark night. The pupil took off and at about 700 feet the port engine began vibrating and throwing off sparks. I took over the controls, throttled back the protesting engine and began the painful business of staggering around the circuit to make a single engine landing. With no radio to warn the ground of any trouble, we carried instead a very pistol pointed down through a hole in the floor between the two pilots. The green and red cartridges were clipped onto the pupil's side of the fuselage, so I instructed him to select and fire a red. Unfortunately, he panicked and failed to replace the pistol in its hole and fired it into the floor instead. The effect was startling as the cockpit filled with acrid red smoke, and soon the floor began to burn. What had been a difficult situation rapidly became an emergency, and I felt like saying, "You have control now," and departing swiftly via the rear door. However, by opening the window and sticking my head out into the slipstream, I could still make out the dim lights of the landing field, so throttling back both engines and, adopting a tolerable gliding speed, we headed our aircraft, lit up like a Christmas tree, towards the landing field. More by luck than good judgment, we crossed the boundary and crash-landed, sliding on the aircraft's belly across the main runway. At the subsequent inquiry, I strongly recommended that my student would be better employed in some trade other than flying. Although we were flying at a very high intensity to get courses through on time, life in our off-duty hours was pleasant and safe, and it would have been easy to sit back and let others do the fighting. Yet I became more and more dissatisfied with the boredom of reading about a war that I could not take part in. Periodically, station routine orders invited volunteers for all kinds of jobs, from ferrying U.S. Lend-Lease aircraft purchases to flying hurricanes catapulted off the decks of merchant ships on the Murmansk convoys. My name went forward for all of them to no avail. Finally, in 1943, I was posted to RAF Greenwood, a newly formed Mosquito Operation Conversion Unit, OCU, on the eastern side of Canada in the province of New Brunswick. Greenwood, unlike Penhold, had been a permanent and well-founded Royal Canadian Air Force station. The Mosquito aircraft were brand new, built in Canadian factories and fitted with Merlin Packard engines. The difference between the Oxford and the Mosquito was about the same as that between a cart horse and a pedigree filly. Some aircraft did not feel comfortable flying, and the Oxford was one. It had to be coaxed, protesting, into the air, whilst the Mosquito, impatient on the ground, took to it joyfully. It was not a difficult machine to master, but I had been taught at CFS and passed on to my students the art of pure flying, correct turns, nicely judged precision circuits and landings, good airmanship and discipline. My OCU instructor, a hard-bitten ex-operational pilot, finally lost his temper with me, "For God's sake, Horsley, stop farting around like a pansy. Try flying by the seat of your pants for a change and throw the bloody thing around as crudely as you can, otherwise you will be shot out of the sky on your first sortie." I didn't much care for him or his manners, but he was quite right and I took his advice to heart. There were about a dozen experienced pilots on the course, together with the same number of rookie navigators straight out of Canadian training schools. The pilots were given just 24 hours to choose mates from these navigators, who hung around the mess in little groups like virginal schoolgirls about to be raped. We had no idea of their professional ability, and in our choice could only depend upon instinct and some feeling of compatibility. So after a very brief courtship, I asked Frank Gunn to team up with me. Frank had been nicknamed Bambi by his fellow navigators, so Bambi he remained, and it was not difficult to see why he had earned this nickname. He had the ears and eyes of a startled fawn, young, innocent and totally unsuited for either flying or war. I really believe he hated it all. The people, the noise and the roughness. It was not long before I discovered that Bambi was nearly always sick as soon as we became airborne, whether from fear or motion I never asked. He took a brown paper bag with him for this purpose and, once over, Bambi settled down quietly and competently to his job. He had probably never been away from home before, and I don't think I was much help to him. There is no doubt that with my assistance he could have remustered to ground duties, but he stuck grimly to flying. Marriage. The course proceeded normally. It is much more difficult to explain the personal events which followed. It was more than just fickleness that made me proceed straight from the tender loving care of one young lady into the arms of another. I had been raised in an age of sexual innocence. The only instruction I had received was from my tutor, who made out that it was not very good for games. The chips were stacked against a healthy male. Nice girls were off limits, masturbation made you stammer, prostitutes passed on unspeakable diseases. In fact, homosexuality at Wellington was looked on as far more normal than having it off with your friend's sister. The war had released a lot of inhibitions about sex, particularly with the influx of foreign troops. The Polish, French and then American servicemen established enviable reputations as able and generous lovers. Indeed, quite a few members of the RAF sewed French or Polish tabs on their shoulders before going on weekend leave in London, thus increasing productivity immeasurably. War also eroded caution, take what you will while you can. Marriage was entered into lightly. Greenwood nestled snugly in the Annapolis Valley within a farming community whose main crop was apples. This proved of popular significance to the RAF, providing both a lethal brew called Applejack and deer stalking at night by torchlight through the orchards. On a free afternoon, about a week after the beginning of the course, Bambi and I visited the local village to do some essential shopping. Waiting for the return bus to camp, we called in at a Red Cross dance in the village hall with nothing more in mind than a free meal. Two young aircrew officers caused quite a stir, and it was easy to bask in the admiring glances of the local maidens. 7. Colombo, September, 1939. Our 1917 vintage Japanese gun is swung inboard. 8. PH gun laying. Trying to hit an orange box outside Colombo Harbor. 9. On mainmast watch. First convoy out of port said, November, 1939. 10. My brother Terence. 11. Skiing for the RAF, 1952. There was one particularly attractive girl. What made her even more tantalizing was the fact that she was not particularly impressed by a flight lieutenant. After a few dances, we sat out. I learned that she was studying psychology at Arcadia University 50 miles down the road and was visiting her grandparents on a farm in the vicinity. I also discovered that she had been engaged to a fellow student at Arcadia who had left early to join the Royal Canadian Air Force and had become one of the first leading Canadian fighter aces of the war, Wing Commander Sidney Ford, DFC and Bar, who had been shot down and killed over France 6 months previously. No wonder she was not impressed by a flight lieutenant without a medal to his name. However, rising to the challenge, I fished for and netted an invitation to a sorority dance at Arcadia University the following weekend. It turned out to be a pleasant evening, but no lights flashed or bells rang. We met 3 or 4 times during the next week or so. It was not a passionate courtship by any stretch of the imagination, but at that point in time we seemed to need and enjoy each other's company. A little over 3 weeks after our first meeting, Phyllis eloped from university and we were married at 7 o'clock one evening in the church at Wolfville, Nova Scotia. Just as simple as that. The whole operation had been touch and go because my station commander had required 2 references for the good character of my bride to be in accordance with King's regulations. Naturally, Phyllis, as a Canadian, felt somewhat humiliated by the King's attitude. Also, her parents, sensing something was amiss, were hurrying north from Indiana to extract their daughter from whatever scrape she was falling into. John Rowley, a flying officer of the Royal Australian Air Force, positioned himself at the door of the church to repel boarders who in the event failed to turn up. We repaired to the officers' mess for our reception and to the local hotel for our wedding night. The course ended almost simultaneously and we were rewarded with a week's leave before reporting to a transit camp near Halifax. Phyllis and I set off by train to Montreal for a delayed honeymoon. We would both agree in retrospect that our honeymoon was not a great success. Her parents had by this time caught up and followed us to Montreal, still shouting foul, and installed themselves in the next bedroom at our hotel. To escape their attentions, we moved to a deserted motel hidden away in the Laurentian Mountains, where getting to know each other better proved even more difficult, since by now she had learnt of my other entanglement on the opposite side of Canada, which I had failed to explain before we were married. I had mistakenly thought that love would rub the slate clean, but this only demonstrated how little I understood women. This omission became a constant sore. Back to England, and the war. We returned to the East, Phyllis to stay with her grandparents on their farm and I to the transit base to fill in papers for my wife to come to England in due course, and to wait for a return passage for myself. It was not long before the end of 1943 that, together with thousands of Canadian troops, I was squeezed like a sardine in a tin can into the Queen Mary. 6 of us, including a Polish officer, were allocated a small cabin designed for a couple, and now jammed with 3 two-tier bunks and with a minute bathroom. The last to arrive was a very elegant and to us elderly flight lieutenant, an ex-airline pilot called Bill Oliver, who had just finished a tour ferrying aircraft between Montreal and the West Indies. He was followed into the cabin by 2 airmen carrying a large, old-fashioned brown leather cabin trunk which, despite our protests, was parked in the only remaining free space. This so enraged our Pole that he retreated to the bathroom, smothered himself with highly scented aftershave and disappeared for the rest of the voyage, no doubt having found a lady willing to share her cabin with him somewhere else on the giant ship. We settled down when Bill Oliver, with a merry "hope you guys know how to play poker," opened up his cabin trunk to display tray upon tray of 40 ounces bottles of bourbon. Meals were taken in 2 shifts, 6 in the morning and 6 at night. As the cabin was permanently blacked out and we drank and played poker continuously, it became difficult to make out whether we were leaving the cabin for breakfast or dinner. Thus we sped unescorted for 5 days across the Atlantic. We never saw the sky during the whole voyage. Even the decks were crowded with troops preferring fresh air and a security safer than the bowels of the ship where they had been billeted. Some months later, my wife, in company with a number of other Canadian girls married to Englishmen, was permitted to leave for England. She had a ghastly Atlantic crossing. Their large convoy not long out of Halifax was repeatedly attacked by packs of U-boats, split up and picked off ship by ship the length and breadth of the ocean. She had the terrifying ordeal of seeing ships sunk around her, the long nights lit by the fires of burning wrecks, her own ship jammed with survivors. At this time, my brother Terence was a lieutenant commander in the Admiralty and had been following the progress of her convoy in the operations room from the time it left Halifax. He called me one day and asked me to meet him in London, where he informed me that a large part of my wife's convoy had been severely attacked, with heavy losses. The convoy had been dispersed and he had no idea of the fate of any stragglers. But eventually they limped one by one into Liverpool. On her arrival in England, Phyllis joined a commune of other Canadian wives married to Englishmen who were like myself away on operations, for by this time Bambi and I had joined our operational squadron and were heavily involved in the war, at last. This commune developed into Little Canada, an island of discontent, constantly criticizing the English and their quaint ideas of plumbing and heating.